Hollywood is so quick to say, if the fate of the whole world's not on the line, then people won't care.
Which is interesting because let's say the book had been about Shasta and Erebus and Brian Wynne just escaping slavery, then the movie would have added this ending.
Welcome to Talking Beasts
from NarniaWeb.com,
where we explore the world of C.S. Lewis
and keep a watchful eye
on the latest Narnia movie news.
This
is Talking Beasts.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. I am your host, Rillian.
And I'm not Jim Fan. Sorry.
Well, you can leave.
Keep listening, though.
Keep listening, Jim Fan. We'll be back. I actually followed
Jim
Fan.
Got her back for one episode. Everyone got all excited.
I actually followed Jim Fan on Instagram, and she's visiting some cool places, and I think she's having a lot more fun doing what she's doing, traveling around again, as opposed to being on this podcast, so I can't really blame her. I'm just happy that I made it down. I was able to sneak downstairs, because that's where I record. It's quieter. And I snuck downstairs, and my son did not see me, because if he sees me go downstairs without him...
How old is he now?
He is almost 2, and he may or may not have cried for, I found out later, 45 minutes during the last recording, because he saw me go downstairs, and I did not take him with me.
Well, most of our listeners, certainly the editor, being me, was aware of that. Later.
Oh, you heard it. I wasn't sure how much
he pops up in the background.
I wasn't sure how much that would come in the last episode.
I'm assuming people, I could definitely hear it with my podcast editor's ear, but listeners, let me know if you heard that.
Yeah. So little
which is totally fine. Keeping it real here.
Yeah. So, but anyway, so we are picking up. Boy, it's been forever. We're picking up.
Where did we leave off? What's even happened in the story?
We left off.
Let us say I have forgotten it.
Ah, you impersonating David Suchet, the best voice of Aslan of all time, also known as the worst voice of Aslan of all time.
Let us say I have forgotten it. Tell us of this horse and his boy first 9 chapters.
So, at the end of chapter 9, across the desert, our heroes had left the tombs, left Lasaraleen behind, left the Narnians behind, who had, of course, made their nighttime escape, going back to Narnia across the sea. And you recall they started making it into the outermost parts of Arkenland, slept in really late one morning, and, you know, Bree's kind of taking a little bit easy in this episode, in that last chapter. And the next chapter we're discussing is chapter 10, The Hermit of the Southern March. So if you read that chapter, our heroes are continuing on, and then eventually they look and they see what looks like a cloud, but it actually turns out it's Rabadash's army. And then the chase is on, and they're galloping, they're trying to go as fast as they can, or as Lewis likes to say, as fast as they thought they could go.
They thought they could.
Which is not quite the same thing.
Uh-huh.
And eventually, lo and behold, a lion appears, and this is the moment where they are, of course, in full breakneck speed. The horses are running, and Shasta surprises really everyone, including himself, by jumping off of Bree and confronting the lion. And this is not until after the lion has already jumped up and scratched Erebus with 10 scratches. But the lion decides to leave, and they end up reaching a kind of a little, I'm not even sure how I kind of envision it. It's kind of, I almost envision it kind of like the secret garden.
Yeah.
But basically a circular wall inside, they find the Hermit of the Southern March, who ends up tending to Erebus, Wynne, and Bree, and tells Shasta, after a brief description of what's going on, you have to run. Run, run, always run. And so
straight ahead. Always straight ahead.
And Shasta takes off. And the hermit continues to care for Erebus, and we have an interesting moment with Bree in the story, where the hermit ends up confronting him, or actually really, Bree kind of confronts himself. And I'll kind of leave that description for the discussion.
Right.
But it's an interesting point in the story, this chapter is, and it's really a shift in the narrative, and not so much maybe the narrative, but the focus of the horse and his boy. And why don't you talk about that, Glumfuddle? Because you've had kind of an evolving thought train on this, I think.
Yeah. I reread it recently, And I think this might have something to do with the fact that, you know, it's been a few months since we were doing these commentaries. So it's been a few months since I was reading The Horse and His Boy. And then in preparation for this episode, I picked it up again. And when I think of The Horse and His Boy, my lasting image is it's a personal story primarily about Shasta, who knows who can sense in his bones, I don't belong here, I belong somewhere else. He says in my chapter one, oh, my father, what is there beyond that hill? And the book is about him learning what's beyond that hill. And so that's kind of my lasting image of it. And it kind of eases into a story that's bigger than that. That's about saving Arkenland and saving Narnia to a large extent as well. So I think just a kind of divorce from all that context of the first nine chapters and picking up and just going right to chapter 10 to prepare for this episode, it was like, well, kind of with this lasting image, if that's what The Horse and His Boy is in my mind, it's such a personal story. I open it up and it's a save the world story. It's we've got to get to Anvard and reach King Lun in time and warn him that the army is going to be here soon.
Which is interesting because let's say the book had been about Shasta and Erebus and Brienne and Wyn just making a journey to Narnia and escaping slavery, then the movie would have added this ending.
That's a really good point. That is a really interesting point. Just like they added the green mist to Voyage of the Dawn Treader, where it wasn't enough for it to be about characters. They had to have higher, like, who's going to, that's not a very sexy thing for a trailer. They have to have the entire space-time continuum on the line. And I'm starting to vent about a pet peeve I often have, movies in particular, where I feel like Hollywood is so quick to say, we've got to add, if the fate of the whole world's not on the line, then people won't care. And that just strikes me as lazy. So I had never put The Horse and His Boy in that category before. And reading it now, I kind of went, is this going to annoy me? Like, am I going to actually start getting annoyed by this shift where it's been just about Shasta and Brienne, Huen, and Erebus, of course, who for different reasons are trying to get to Narnia. And now it's, oh, just kidding. Now it's about saving all of Narnia. And I was trying to think, why has this never bothered me before? And so I wanted to get some other perspectives on it. So then you posted that thing in the Facebook group.
Yeah. And there's an interesting comment there. And Sarah Lynn said, I think that this portion of the story is a wonderful culmination, revealing what each character is meant to do. Now the reader understands that Horse and His Boy is not just about the horses and humans getting to Narnia for just themselves. Rather, they are called there by Aslan at just that moment to fulfill the prophecy spoken over Shasta at birth. And that is an interesting... I'd say that what Lewis is doing, this is kind of the right way to do it, because he's expanding the character development. The characters are, you know, Shasta thought, really his mental world was pretty small. He didn't think about talking beasts. He didn't really have much of imagination, actually. But he did have this feeling that he just did not belong. And that was kind of the, mentally, what was kind of almost like trying to burst his own bubble, so to speak. But, can you hear him?
Yes, I can. he's got some opinions, too.
He may have found out that I'm gone. So,
or he may disagree with what you're saying.
Or may disagree with what I'm saying. Yeah, because I'm broadcasting over the speakers at home, of course. This is kind of a continuation of the character development. You know, Erebus isn't just thinking about escaping slavery. She has to think about actually helping two countries she's never been to, two lands she's never seen. And the same with Shasta, because... now they can't just think about, like, everyone kind of starts off thinking about themselves. And then as the journey continues on, they end up thinking about another friend or three more friends and thinking about the friendships and the group. And now they're actually, their loyalty in terms of being able to take personal risk and endure hardship for the right thing is now beyond just their own little group. So I think that this would be kind of the right way to do it. But what's interesting is even as I was reading through this chapter, it is still very character-centric. It doesn't pull back. And even just the way later on that the battle is told, it's still very much through the eyes and experiences of our central characters.
Absolutely. I think you're right about it's still character-driven. As I was thinking through, why doesn't it bother me? It totally seems like the kind of thing that I would get annoyed at a story for, to take the lazy way out. It's, oh, the whole world's on the line. Like, I was invested in the characters. You didn't have to do that. But obviously, it's still so much on the line for our characters. They're trying to get home. They're trying to escape to Narnia. They're trying to escape slavery. And then they figure out there may be... I think Erebus... Is this, I can't remember. Is this in the book or is this just in the radio drama? But Erebus, I think, that says something like, we might as well have not come at all if we don't reach King Loon in time. I don't quite remember if she says that in the book or not, but it is true. That now, reach around your microphone.
Reach around my microphone to type.
Look it up. Word search. Thank God for digital. But that's true. They've come all this way to try to escape their former lives of different forms of slavery, to get to Narnia, only to find out that Narnia is in danger. So their ability to get home that they've been trying for the entire book is now on the line. So it's still very much tied to them. And like you say...
It's not in the book.
It's not in the book. Okay.
It's not in the book.
So that is...
You pulled a Peter Jackson and misremembered what was in the book.
He did that one time, didn't he?
Return of the King commentaries. He just can't... He's read 12 different scripts. He can't remember what is the book.
I can't remember what's in the book. And we'll get to that in the next episode, possibly.
Spoiler.
Talk about Lord of the Rings. And you're totally right that the emotions are so character driven. Lewis doesn't talk very much about, they knew they had to get there or all Narnia would be doomed. But rather, it's when they're running away from, they're trying to erase the army, basically. The run was very grueling for the horses. And then it talks about, like you mentioned, the horses were doing all they could or all they thought they could. And then when the lion appears, they feel the difference. Oh, now they're really doing all that they can. So it's very much centered on the emotions of the characters. And my wife pointed out to me an interesting line today. When Shasta, the lion appears and it's, crouching over Erebus and Huin. And Shasta, Bree is... I love how it says Bree later said that he didn't hear Shasta say we have to go back. And being a very truthful horse, we have to believe him. But Shasta jumps off his horse and is running back. And it says something like, Shasta had never done anything like this before, and he didn't know why he was doing it now. And I had always taken that to mean, well, of course, this is a very unique situation to be in, to be running towards a lion who's hurting your friend. And what do you do in that situation? But... my wife took it a different way. She was saying, I think it's more about he's never had to put his own safety ahead of his own to this extent. He's never had something almost like this honorable to stand up for. And I've only had the last couple hours to kind of ponder that. But that does make more sense that it says not only he'd never done this before, but he didn't know why he was doing it now. So it's almost... he's never had friends this close before, and this is the first time in his life he's had to have that sense of that protective sense of someone else to that extent. But you're right; it stays the stakes get bigger, but Lewis still wants us to be thinking about how is this affecting our characters primarily.
Well, and I think your wife made a really good point because it's always important to remember. Literature is written, especially children's literature, is written differently today. C.S. Lewis was someone who fought in the trenches. He was a, I think he was a, I don't know much about the British military ranks, but I think it was Lance Corporal or a Sergeant in World War One. I'm not sure, but he and Tolkien were both fought in the trenches. Lewis actually lost some of his best friends. His main best friend, actually, he lost in the trenches. And they had made a vow, kind of a little note about Lewis. They had each made a vow that the other, whoever survived, would take care of the other's family. And so C.S. Lewis took care of, was it Patty Moore? I think that was his name.
Mrs. Moore. I was Mrs. Moore. I couldn't remember.
Mrs. Moore. I think his name was Patty.
I thought
friend.
Her first name was Mrs., so
yeah,
I guess not.
No, I think his friend's name was Patty. But he took care of Mrs. Moore for many, many years. And I think even into the like the timeline, if you see the movie Shadowlands, I think she was still alive during that time. And she was a very difficult woman. And so it wasn't a really pleasurable experience, but he was someone who understood honor, loyalty, bravery, and death. And so he took those experiences, and he's writing for children, obviously, but he definitely wanted to infuse that. And so I think that he kind of understood being in the mind of someone who's thrown into incredibly dangerous situations. And maybe, yeah, well, he didn't know why he was doing what he was doing.
Never done anything like this.
Didn't know why he was doing it at that moment.
And most of us have never been in that kind of situation before and don't exactly know mm-hmm. how we would react.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think that it is an interesting, it's not, in one hand, it's not really surprising reading it, but he has to kind of, I think, bring the reader out of those moments a little bit just to say, hey, keep perspective. This is Shasta we're talking about. And if you were maybe writing the character just along a natural train of development of, well, here he is, he's just kind of going along his path and there's no big shifts in what he's experiencing. He wouldn't normally do that.
That's just interesting stuff. And again, the whole world's on the line, but these are the things I find myself thinking about when I think about The Horse and His Boy. Lewis raises the stakes, but doesn't lose sight of what it's really about. And I've been really reflecting on, for whatever reason, and some people, I think some people I say this to find this completely intuitive and some find it totally counterintuitive, but it's for some reason it's so much easier in general to care about, certainly in storytelling. It's easy to like watch the whole world being destroyed and the aliens blowing up New York or whatever and just kind of go, eh. But it's so much easier to care about one person. And it's funny, like some people think that makes complete sense. Some people go, oh, I never thought of it right that way. I don't know.
Well, here's a simple, I mean, these are two radically different films, but one flies in the face of this current, the world must be at stake for you to care, philosophy. You know, just ask yourself which film has you kind of more on the edge of your seat and more wondering what will happen to the protagonist, The Avengers or watching Castaway?
Yeah, they are very different movies.
Well, very different movies.
In fairness, yeah, Castaway is only one character and Avengers, the entire world is on the line. I think The Avengers is a... If we're going to say with Marvel movies, I think Thor the Dark World might be a better example of one that the stakes get raised so high at the end. Well, then again, I'm not really that invested in the characters in that one either. I'll have to think of another example.
Okay, same
with superhero movies. I think Wonder Woman, the stakes get really big and the scale gets really big at the end.
Man, the one movie I haven't seen. Thanks a lot, jerk.
You can hear our podcast about it if you want. I did with Riadian. But I think that the stakes get really big and it feels so epic. And I really was feeling pretty invested in the character. And then it just gets so big at the end, I kind of lose that character a little bit. I lose what she's feeling and what's going on. And Avengers, I think, is overall a positive example of raising the stakes, even with a lot of different characters. But overall, it still feels pretty character-based at the end there. We have... their little arcs are being
sure
resolved.
Yeah, and I'm not saying it was not character based at all, but to a certain extent. But really, what is the struggle? The struggle is defeating all the guys invading New York. It's not so much a and that's why like it's funny because my wife is experiencing all these fun things for the first time. I don't know how she survived. She's read the Chronicles of Narnia now for the first time.
Oh, she's done.
Well, she's holding off on the last battle. She does that. She'll get to the last chapter or the last thing of something she's really enjoying. She just doesn't want it to end. So she.
I know people that do that. I don't get it.
I don't get it either. But I think you can read them again. Okay, you have them right there. But she hasn't read the last battle. She started. Oh my goodness. She started. I think Monday before last. Well, probably Wednesday before last on Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. She just finished book 5 today.
She stopped reading Narnia and started reading Harry Potter?
I know. So, trust me, she's going to wait. She's not going to read Deathly Hallows for a while because she's going to want to wait. She started watching the Marvel movies. Anyway, long segue back to Marvel. She rewatched Thor, the original Thor, and I was watching it and I thought, you know, it definitely has a number of weaknesses in the movie, but I thought, man, this really is, I think, the more I've watched it, one of the better movies because so much of the struggle really is about that character development, and it's not even handled the best way. But the fact that so much of what's really at stake in the story is Thor's redemption makes it a much more interesting story, I think, than, like, especially Thor the Dark World, where there's the world at stake.
Yeah, the first half of that movie, I think, is pretty good. It's okay, because it's so character-focused. And then I think they have to expedite his arc and redemption, because they have to get the MCU in place for the Avengers, so they rush through it.
Yeah, you made a point. I think you said, yeah, I think that from the time he's cast out to when he, you know, becomes a completely different person is about 18 hours or something like that.
Yes, because they have to rush it to get everything in place for the Avengers, basically. But they started out pretty good. Anyway, so... yeah, for whatever reason, it's just easier to, it's so much better if you can just develop a couple characters, make you care about them, than take the lazy way out and say, oh, the whole world will be destroyed. I mean, even, this isn't even just fantasy. In real life, I think we're seeing much of a push towards, I feel like I'm seeing more stories about, oh, here's something really interesting that happened to this random person wherever. I think we're seeing more, those stories are start for whatever, you know, if they're attention getting and
in the midst of reading, oh my goodness, World War III is gonna break out. I mean, you actually see headlines like that, you know,
right? And it's easy to become desensitized to those, but I'm seeing more. I feel like I'm seeing more of a push towards, oh, here's something this interesting happened. Maybe the internet has kind of pushed for this, where this one video of something that happened to someone can go viral.
Well, everyone has the voice, and you can make the argument that the little kid live streaming on Facebook has. In some ways, an equal footing to the New York Times, but that kind of gets to, we can talk about that later.
for our something else.
I think you're saying your point is that we're craving that human connection. In the midst of all these connections across the world, we're craving that connection to another person. And here's a story that gives it and doesn't really seem to lose it.
I hate to admit it, but I was pondering this, just, you know, they had the shooting in Jacksonville a few days ago.
Yeah, horrible.
At the time of this recording, a few days ago. And I just hate to admit it, but I think I got a notification of it, like a Google News notification or something. And my first reaction wasn't to click on it and learn more. It was, oh, another one.
Another one.
It's become routine. And now I know this is. But that goes for events on, no matter, like, any, even events on a larger scale, it's easy, and that kind of counts as larger scale because it's such a huge issue, it keeps coming back. I know it was only a few people, but it's still, like, it's such a huge ongoing event. But I think I've gotten so desensitized to these big events, and it's easier to get my attention when it's, oh, here's this interesting thing that happened to one person, and I'm not happy about that. We can't get desensitized to this.
And here's something interesting.
I was sick when I realized that I'd reacted that way.
And here's something interesting. It's like Lewis is, you know, Lewis went through World War I, the war to end all wars, but a lot of, I think, just the way that people talk about his experience, it's in the context of loss of relationships. He lost his friends, so he was going through a really cataclysmic time. But a lot of his perspective on it was driven in terms of, well, how do the people matter? You know, what human lives actually matter? And so he's kind of telling the story here. But you're right, we do, when we lose that human touch and we forget that there are real individual people, not just, because of course we all know those groups of people, but we can be, like, I remember, I can see kind of what you're saying, I can't even remember when the last one was, but you see them once in a while, you'll see, you know, newsflash saying, you know, 30 some people in Kabul, Afghanistan, die in a market with a suicide bomber or something.
Yeah.
And you just kind of think, oh man, that's horrible. Another one, you know?
Exactly.
But sometimes I thought, you know, sometimes one time I stopped and I thought, those were individual people, individual
persons,
men,
yep,
women, little kids, you know, people who had their own goals, hopes, dreams.
So easy to lose sight of that. Yep.
We lose that. And it takes away. We lose so much of the important perspective, I think. And it's interesting that Lewis does try to keep that even as he is expanding. And I think that's why it doesn't lose the focus that it does. Or that's why this focus shift,
the emotional focus stays the same. Even as the stakes get big, we're focusing on what are our four main characters, what are they feeling in this moment right now? We're not overly concerned about what's happening with mm-hmm. We don't cut away to news footage of the White House or something, or the equivalent of We're staying just with our characters' perspectives and emotionally what they're struggling with, and that makes the story. It keeps it compelling. It's weird to say it keeps it compelling despite the fact that there's a potentially world-changing event going on. But I think that's the way it works in storytelling. And I feel like Lewis was very consciously aware of that. You see how he's just trying to wrench your attention away from, no, it's not about Anvard and Narnia. It's about like being on the line. But it's about our four main characters. He keeps it there. And I love what you said, though, about how if this wasn't in the book, it would have been in the movie adaptation if they made one. They would have added the
it would have, but I was even thinking as I was reading the book, because I actually finished it, because I wasn't sure how far we were going to go, and I thought, I was going through it again, I thought, you know, yes, this will be, if they make the movie, this will be in the movie, but it will be told very differently. It's going to be, right. You know, big sweeping, you know, cinematography and sweeping film score, which I love, but yeah, you know, it's definitely gonna be,
may have something to do with why Lewis chose to tell the battle the way he does, but obviously we'll get to that.
But before that, we do have a really interesting moment that it's a very important moment for the character of Bree, because again, you know, shift in the story, but he doesn't even follow Shasta right away. He continues focusing on the characters of Bree, and Bree is absolutely humiliated.
That's right. No, because Shasta gets sent on to warn King Loon, and the Hermit of the Southern March just tells him, run straight ahead, straight ahead. And then Shasta runs out of the story for half a chapter, isn't it? And then we stay with Erebus, Huin, and Bree.
Yeah. And, which is not, again, not how you would tell a movie.
In the movie.
Which you can't really. It's very hard to do. You can do things in a book that you can't really do in a movie.
Uh-huh. You've got that momentum of Shasta going to warn King Loon. I think I'm not saying I oppose this change necessarily, but certainly in a movie you'd tend to say, you got to keep the momentum going.
Exactly. And you'd be at risk of losing moments like this where Bree is so humiliated about how he acted and how, in comparison to Shasta.
Yeah.
And in contrast to Shasta. And he's saying, I don't even want to go. I don't even want to go to Narnia. I'm not going to go. I'm just going to go back to slavery because that's all I'm good for.
Right.
And
he's just so embarrassed that when Shasta, when Huin and Erebus are in danger, Shasta's shouting, we got to go back, a slave boy.
Yeah,
who's never seen battle before,
who was never raised right, like all of them, kind of like to think that they were raised right.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, that even, you know, Erebus says, well, we were all running as fast as we could, and he says Shasta didn't.
Right.
At least he was running in the right direction. And there's a great line from the Hermit where he comes up and he's overhearing the conversation. He says, my good horse, you've lost nothing but your self-conceit. And he says, you're not quite the great horse you'd come to think from living among poor dumb horses. Of course, you are braver and cleverer than them. You could hardly help being that. It doesn't follow that you'll be anyone very special in Narnia. But as long as you know you're nobody special, you'll be a very decent sort of horse on the whole, and taking one thing with another.
So maybe this would be changed for the movie too, but Bree's lesson in this story is that he's not special. I mean, how much of an anti-Hollywood message is that for any kind of protagonist?
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, maybe it's a good thing Disney's not making it, but...
Besides Fight Club.
True.
The you are not special is not a message we see.
Read the book, didn't see the movie.
Oh, I've seen the movie, haven't read the book, so we should talk about that. That's one of my top 10. I just recently did a definitive top 10 list of my favorite movies. And
I saw the post.
Fight Club's on them. Maybe that could be a something else if someone wants to talk about those. But yeah, Bree goes on this journey of, you know, he's the noble war horse. And of course, he feels like he's amazing. And Shasta has been put down his whole life. And of course, he feels like he's nothing. And the truth turns out to be that Shasta turns out to be the hero, not just a hero, but a prince. And Bree turns out to be a coward when it mattered most. And then, of course, there's not going to be anything special about being a talking horse very soon. So love that that journey. And of course, we'll see in the next chapter coming up soon, how she reacts to Aslan and how Erebus is humbled here.
Yeah, and that's a great moment for those characters, and we'll discuss that, because again, it reminded me of how Huin is really kind of the most unsung hero in the story.
There's the subtle hero,
definitely. Before we discuss something else, we do have something else before we discuss something else. And just because you completely forgot to give me a heads up on the Stump and Arnie Webber question on the last episode, I forgot to give it to you at the beginning of this one so you could think about it.
Oh, I didn't feel like I needed one. I'm sorry you felt like you needed one.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess you don't when you're Master Jedi Luke. So, anyhow, this is a tough one. It's a tough one.
All right, give me my Stump and Arnie Webber question.
This is just mean. What are the three colors of the phoenix in Aslan's garden?
Okay, who submitted this one?
Diggory Kirk.
Okay, well, thank you.
Diggory, thank you. Thank you. Colors. We are keeping score behind the scenes.
So this is the magician's nephew. Diggory's come to the garden to get the tree that becomes the, or to get the apple that becomes the tree of protection. And he sees that's what we're talking about, right? In the magician's nephew.
Yes. I really hope so.
And then
as I'm looking at the answer because I can't think of where else it would be. I could look that up.
And then the phoenix. It was a bird. I don't remember it being a phoenix, honestly, even. But I remember there was a bird that looks at Diggory because Diggory's thinking about taking the apple and then he realizes, oh, but boy, you shouldn't steal and all that, and decides not to. I feel like I saw a painting, like some artwork of this. I don't think it was Bane's. But I feel like I saw some artwork of this. And I feel like Superman colors are coming to mind, blue, red, and yellow, but I'm definitely not confident enough of that to take a guess. So why don't you go ahead? I'm going to go ahead and blow Queen Susan's horn and ask for a hint.
The hint is not very much. It just says the breast is one color, the tail another, and the head is crested with another color.
Well, I'm going to go with... I feel like I wonder if gold is in there. Well, I really don't know, so I'm going to go ahead and say red, blue, and gold. Final answer.
You are 33% correct.
Okay.
It is scarlet, which is the crest, purple for the tail, and saffron for the breast.
Gotcha. Okay, I'll accept 33%, I guess. And thank you for giving me scarlet, even though I said red. Appreciate that.
I think that anyone would.
Okay.
Don't
expect me to extend the same to you.
It's fuchsia, you troglodyte. Seafoam green. Oh, no, sorry.
All right. I think we're done talking about Narnia.
And now it's time for something else. The part of the show where Narnia Webbers talk about something else.
As you may be aware, Rillian, there's this thing called Facebook. What you may not be aware of is there's this thing called politics. I said it here. I acknowledge the existence of politics on Narnia. What is this, Star Wars Episode 1? But
politics.
The two often mix for better or worse, and I've been wondering. And I think we can talk about this without giving away our political opinions. Let's see if
you're
we can
right. We're going to talk about Trump and Brexit all in one episode.
Now you've gone too far. Not. My heart just skipped a beat. It's such a politically charged time, to say the least, and there's so much division and so much discussion. So much of it ends up on social media. What I have found myself wondering, is it inherently, is there something inherent about Facebook as a platform that makes it very, very difficult to have civil political conversations? Within the past couple of years, I pretty much just started, if it was one of my friends, I discovered that you can unfollow someone without unfriending them. And if there was someone that was posting too much political stuff, I would just unfollow them. so that their posts don't appear in my news feed, but I'm still friends with them, so I can still view their page and stuff. But what do you think? Is there just something inherent about Facebook that makes it actually virtually impossible to have a civil conversation about with a disagreement on Facebook?
I think there's something inherent about social media that makes it difficult, but I'm not so confident on exactly what it is. I think that one of the things that lends itself to the viciousness that we see on social media is the anonymity, or sorry, better yet to say, the perception that I am anonymous. It'd be interesting to see some psychological studies. Some people, some psychologists have even attributed road rage, the increase in road rage recently.
I was just thinking of that.
To this perception that you are, while I am in a vehicle, I'm anonymous. And no one knows who I am, and there will be no ramifications afterwards for what I did in that moment. And that's something, like, even my hometown newspaper, they used to allow comments on their page, and then they said, you know what, we're going to get rid of anonymous comments. And then they said, you know what, we're not even going to allow you to comment unless you're using a Facebook account. Because it's a little more verified than just creating some username. But it's interesting how, because for those who don't know me, I love political discussions. I love religious discussions. I love having those with people who disagree with me on all those different topics. And I do not have those discussions on Facebook. And it's not that you can't have those discussions on Facebook, because I have. But it's so easy for someone to kind of launch themselves into the middle of a discussion and kind of throw it off the rails, or even maybe take things the wrong way. And we don't put a lot of thought into what we're writing. You can write and convey nuanced opinions and kind of, you can write satire, but we don't even do a very good job detecting satire when it's not on social media, when it's on a very intentional essay or a column, you know? So I think that part of it is people have this perception that, you know, I can just blow off some steam here and, you know, because what I've discovered is when you have those conversations in real life, people don't get quite as angry in real life.
Absolutely.
They don't. They are more likely, I think, to just shut down because they don't know how to have the intelligent discussion. And they'll just shut down and walk away. But they're not going to blow up at you the way they would if they were on Facebook or Twitter. I think that those are some of the things. I think it's the anonymity. And it's so easy to just punch it, you know? And you're not looking the person in the face.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, like, what you brought up about road rage and anonymity. Sorry, I have a hard time with that word.
Say it five times fast. Road rage and anonymity.
Can't say it one time slow. Anyway, but I've always I thought of the road rage comparison too. I didn't think of it as that I somehow feel anonymous when I'm driving. I just thought of it as the frustrating feeling of, like, I can't communicate with the other person. You know, if someone cuts me off in traffic, there's this tendency to assume, oh, that jerk.
Yeah.
Maybe it was an honest mistake. And look, be careful driving when you're driving, kids. But maybe, like, how many times have I cut someone off by accident and gone, oh, darn, I didn't see him, and they honk at me. And I wish there was, instead of, we have turn signals, I wish there was a signal that said, I'm sorry, it was a mistake. Or sometimes I'll accidentally, like, what if I accidentally bump, like, recently I accidentally bumped my horn. I'm sure the person's going, what's he honking at? And, like, it's that number one, that frustration of not being able to communicate, not being able to look the person in the eye and say, why'd you do that? Number one. And number two, a tendency to assume the worst. In the case of road rage, we can't communicate with them. We assume they're going, yeah, I'm going to cut you off because you're stupid. That's what we assume. And on Facebook, where it's very, you know, you're reading text and yet you have to project some tone into it, unless the writer is very, very careful.
Lots of emojis.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to assume a negative tone unless the writer is extremely careful. So that's a big part of it, is that we hear someone who disagrees with us and we hear them talking like this. I think that's a big part of it, is that mode of communication.
Yeah, it's even something like a simple comment. I'm just thinking, like, let's say someone just here's my manifesto that I know will change your mind, and they post it on Facebook, and someone says, even were to post a comment saying, interesting, I don't know what that means. You know, like in a conversation, you can say it in a way where it's just like, explain that. I don't understand. But if you read the post, right. You just go like, you know, you just come off.
It feels very dismissive. And a lot of times I think people, there's a tendency, people will say things. It's ironic, really, but I hope that's the right use of the word ironic. But they'll say things on Facebook to all of their Facebook friends, which maybe that's 100, a few hundred, whatever, that they wouldn't say to someone face to face. And maybe they have this opinion they feel very strongly about, they want to express. And so a Facebook post gives you the chance to say it to everyone but no one at the
same
time.
Exactly. You could post it and then just walk away. And if you want to look at the comments, you can. You don't have to. You can ignore the comments. You can just, you know, gloss over them. But though you've said something to someone and they're having some kind of emotional reaction to it, most likely.
But I think... And I think people who read it, though, that's frustrating. When you see, it's sort of the equivalent of seeing, like, a prominently displayed sign somewhere that's saying something that you don't agree with, but stating it as fact. And you have this, oh, that's so annoying. Like, you're just seeing someone say something.
Commute every day to work.
Exactly. But that frustration of seeing something that I don't agree with, and you're just saying it. It's like, sort of like, look me in the eye and say it. And, like, ask for my opinion. There's something about just stating it like it's fact. To no one in particular, that I also think causes that reaction. So yeah. I have seen civil conversations take place.
Yes,
but it's on Facebook, political conversations. But it's usually people that I know are being extremely careful. They're aware. If you're aware of the limitations of this form of communication, you can be. I think you can do it. But I do think. In answer to the kind of the question of is there something inherent about Facebook that makes it difficult? Definitely, but that doesn't mean it can't be done. I've seen it done.
Yeah, well, and we're at a very interesting time, and you know, when people post comments and stuff, I'm interested across the pond. You know, a friend of mine who's he's an American living in the UK, and he has for many, many years, but of course, he's still an American, and he likes to discuss things with. Brits over there to get their perspectives on different things. Cause of course, you know, there's, you know, Western civilization, but of course there's definitely a lot of differences. And I'm sometimes curious, now in America, anyway, I don't want to speak too broadly, but in America, there's a hostility even to being civil. Like if someone says, hey guys, can't we just have a civil discussion? Some people will turn around and blast that person. Like, well, how dare you? You know, these things matter, you know. Yeah, well, right. You know, just shouting your opinion is honestly kind of boring and uninteresting. Talking about why we believe what we believe is and the foundational principles that we're basing our beliefs on is much more interesting. And, you know, and that's why, you know, you have some, there's some, I'll just keep their names out just because even though these people who talk to all kinds of different people are, I think, very polite in many ways and, you know, they're still, for some reason, very politically charged. But there's some YouTubers that have taken off, and they have, thousands and thousands of subscribers. And basically, they just have long-form interviews and discussions. Some of them are 2-4 hours long. You know, these long interviews with people who completely disagree with them. And they just have a conversation with them. But you can't. One of the reasons you can't do that on social media is you get your friend who posts the book as the comment. You go, oh my goodness, I have to read this. No, right. No, I'm not gonna. I'll read the first paragraph and the ending, and I'll hope that I got it. You know, because I just don't have time. I've got a life, and so you're not gonna read that. But that's how we have conversations. You know, you and I have some. You know, if these were comments, we'd be making long comments. But you know, it's interesting the entire time. We're not just bored with it. Just talking to one another, and we don't feel this need to, we'll make comments to each other within the podcast, but it's got to be in 120 characters or less, or 140. I don't tweet that much. I do, but I just use look at the circle as it fills up. I don't actually count the characters.
People will retweet things and comment on them. Like your ability to go back and forth is so limited, but maybe that makes things worse. I don't know, where you just have to say, you're wrong. Here's why, really quick. I don't know. I haven't paid that much attention.
Well, and then you get the threads like, okay, part one of 12. Like, oh my goodness, you know. So people try to get back out of that. But and I think, you know, in social media, really, it's not just Facebook and Twitter. It's also YouTube, which we forget. It's technically narniweb.com is social media. Even not just the Facebook group, but the website, because we're commenting and discussing even outside of the forum.
It's easier to be anonymous on YouTube, so it's probably worse overall, the comments on there.
Yeah, well, and I think that I really think that that is part of it, is this kind of it's kind of like how, you know, people will egg a house when no one's watching them. You know, people will do all kinds of things to vandalize someone's property, like in the darkness, but once you shine the light on them, they scurry.
Well, hopefully in our comments section, we can have some civil conversation. So just keep in mind some things we've said and post.
Except you're not allowed to discuss the Lady of the Green Kirtle in the, or ish, whether she's the same person as the White Witch in the Silver Tree.
Because that is the one thing that, that's the one issue on Narnia Web that has actually been
of
banned.
Of all things, yeah, nothing else.
there's something about that issue that just makes people go crazy.
Yeah, nothing about Republicans or Democrats or anything else has been banned.
No, that's fine.
But the Lady of the Green Kirtle, yeah, that was the one banned thing.
All right, so that is it for this episode. Are we ready for the outro?
I think we are ready for the outro.
I guess I can do it this time, and I'm hoping Jim Fan will do it next time. We will continue the Horse and His Boy commentary. I don't know if we will finish it this... yeah, not next time. I don't know if we'll finish it this season. The reason being that we only have Jim Fan for a short time. After early next year, Jim Fan is going to be in another country. She'll be gone. It'll be very difficult
not
to get
her. Not
the
one she's in now. And another country.
A different another country.
I think she's a spy, dude. I think she's a secret agent. It's like IMF.
No comment.
Jim Fan, if your mission, if you choose to accept it. Sorry, guys, got to take off.
I can neither confirm nor deny that. But so we've only got Jim Fan for a short time, and there are a handful of topics that I just really want Jim Fan to be a part of, and I think it'll be so much better if we have the three of us. So this could potentially be the last Horse and His Boy commentary episode of the season, and then we'll finish the Horse and His Boy book next season. But I really think we're not forgetting about the Horse and His Boy. I really want to finish it. I'm really enjoying these. I know a lot of you, especially Colonel Clink, really enjoying it. Well, we've got Jim Fan. I really want to, there's a few things I really want to do. We'll get there.
We'll get there.
All right. Is it outro time?
It is outro time. Are you ready for the outro?
I'm going to do it.
I bungled it last time, so now I'm going to watch you humiliate yourself like Brie.
You've been listening to Talking Beasts, a NarniWeb.com podcast. Be sure to subscribe and post a comment below or in the Talking Beasts Facebook group. You can also email us at podcast@NarniWeb.com, Rillian@NarniWeb.com, JimFan15@NarniWeb.com, although she's not in this one, or Glumpole@NarniWeb.com. Special thanks to the rest of our podcast team, AJ Aiken, Ryidian, and the Rose Tree Dryad. For the latest news on the Silver Chair movie, visit NarniWeb.com. This fall, look for a new episode of Talking Beasts on the 7th and 17th of every month. So we'll be back on September 17th, and we'll be comparing Narnia to Lord of the Rings. Until then, further up and further in.